morning, Santa Fe, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Baking Company on Cordova Road and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We're also podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can listen to the program at any time of day or night. The site made possible by Dotfoil Computer Systems, Computer Services, right here in Santa Fe on the web at dotfoil.com. I'd like now to introduce tea connoisseur Frank Murphy. Welcome to the Radio Cafe. We're talking today about tea.
Well, good morning, Mary Charlotte.
It's wonderful to have you here. I didn't even know until I met you the other day that it was possible to be a student of tea at the depth that you are. You've been studying tea for 13 years with a tea master named Roy Fong in San Francisco. How did your life take this direction?
Well, I was a seminarian and studying theology. And my wife brought me some teas that she brought back from her native San Francisco. And one of them I decided to try one morning, and I was really astounded by the taste of it. And in fact, I had an epiphany over the experience that I had, and I was fascinated by why I would have this experience with tea.
Now, what do you mean by an epiphany? What happened?
Well, I realized I had something very different in my body than I was used to. And there were things going on in my body that I wasn't used to, because I've been a tea drinker all my life. And things were happening. I was feeling energy was moving around in my body differently. And I decided to sit down at the table and let this thing roll, you know, kind of yield to it and let it wash over me. And open to it and see what would happen. And the experience just kept on going on and on. And mostly what I felt was openings happening, movement in my body, like with the experience of qi, say, through different acupuncture treatments. I even felt my heart open to some degree. You know, different types of stimulating things going on.
Now, that was really good tea.
Yes, we actually had some of that the other day called Pu'er.
Now, the way you study tea and the way you think about tea, there's really a deep spiritual component to it, and that's the part that I'd never even thought about. Is this part of the tradition of tea, the whole opening to the spiritual realm?
Yes. Tea's been grown on monastic properties for hundreds and hundreds of years, and I think the thing that's so popular with monastics and religious with tea is that it really can, some teas have the capacity to bring you down into what the old biofeedback people used to call an alpha or a theta state of meditation. Especially the green teas or the white teas that have less of caffeine in them, they bring you to a point of wakeful tranquility, if you will, where you're deeply relaxed and quite alert at the same time, often a meditation experience. And the actual practice and the ritual of preparing tea lends itself quite nicely to the meditation practice itself, because you have to be mindful of what you're doing, or you can chip the porcelain, or worse, destroy the tea.
So in monasteries in China, Japan, what, all over the East, they actually use tea as part of the practice?
More in Japan, and there's some Taoist practices still that use it. And I only know really of the ones in China and Japan. Of course, Japan has the wonderful Japanese tea ceremony, and of course we can all partake of that down at Sunrise Springs.
What is the difference between the Japanese and Chinese tea ceremonies?
Well, as far as I understand it, the Japanese tea ceremony is a more formal ritual that's focused on the ritual itself and not so much on the tea. It's a wonderful ceremony, and they use one particular type of tea, and I think that most of the schools, particularly the Urizenki school in Japan, focus on a particular ceremony. I think all the other schools do too. But in China, the focus is more on the connoisseurship of tea, so there can be hundreds and hundreds of different types of tea ceremonies in China, depending on the province or the area or the tea.
We're talking to tea connoisseur Frank Murphy. What is tea? It's one species of plant from which the tea leaf comes?
Yes, it's what's called a broadleafed evergreen, much like oleanders or rhododendrons are broadleafed evergreens, but of course they're not related. And there's only one species of tea called Camellia sinensis. And from this species, within this house, if you will, there's hundreds, probably thousands, of what's called varietals and cultivars within the species. And from that, you can get white teas and green teas and all different. There's six different classifications of tea, but basically all tea comes from this one species of tea, Camellia sinensis. And the two most popular varietals within that house is, of course, the China tea varietals and the India tea varietals, the Assam teas.
Now, it's the same tea that grows in China, tea plant that grows in China and India, but there's within that species, just as within the species of dog, you've got poodles and terriers, there's different varieties of tea within that species of plant.
Yes, and there's white teas. Some white teas, some provinces of China lend themselves better to the production of white teas, like Fujian province in China is known for producing white teas and oolongs. And Zhejiang province is noted for its green teas, and Taiwan they grow a lot of oolongs. So within the species of Camellia sinensis, you have these thousands of varietals. And even the tea bushes look different when you are strolling through the plantations and the gardens in China. You'll see some leaves that are a little larger, some that are more serrated around the edge. Maybe the bush will look different, like the large-leafed Assam tea in India is different looking. It's just a bigger bush than the ones in China.
Now, to get from the tea plant to a cup of tea is a big process. At what time of year, is there one time of year where the tea plant is harvested, or as an evergreen, can you just keep harvesting it all the time?
Well, it really depends on where it's harvested, where it's growing, and certainly in Taiwan and Africa and South America, it's harvested several times a year, up to four times a year. But in China, it's mostly harvested in late March, and that's when, kind of like for tea connoisseurs, that's the most exciting time of the year because of the, it's kind of like the Beaujolais Nouveau time of year for the wine people, and that's what we wait for. But mostly it's harvested a couple of times a year. Like in India, there might be a spring harvest, and of course the Darjeeling's popular cultivation on harvesting is in the fall. The second flush harvest is what they call that.
So what happens? People go out and do they pick the leaves by hand?
Yes, they pluck the leaf off. They pluck the new growth off at the very tip of the twig, and those are the leaf buds. And sometimes they pick the first or second leaf down the twig as well. It's called the two leaves and a bud. And once they pick those off with their thumb and forefinger, they put them in a basket, like a wicker basket, on their back, so they're carrying them. And the moment that happens, the leaf starts to wither. And they bring those into the factories and lay them out on large bamboo mats on the floors to let them wither in the open air and oxidize a little bit. Depending on the type of tea, every tea is processed differently, and then every farm does something a little bit differently as well. But with a green tea, the simplest way to explain it is that the women pick the tea, bring the tea in, and let it expose itself, wither to the open air. And then they use these big woks that are heated to a certain degree, and they throw the green tea leaves in there and make sure that the leaves are continuing to stay in motion so they're not scalded or burned. And you continuing to get the moisture out of the leaf through the withering and the wok firing, the pan frying. And then you leave it out again for a while in the open air. And basically you can drink green tea the same day that it's produced. You can't do that with an oolong or a black tea because it takes a while longer to produce that deep, full-bodied richness that we're so familiar as Americans with, like a black tea.
So the green tea and the black tea come from the same leaf, but the what would you call it, cooking process, roasting process is different.
The whole process is different, yes. It's not just, when you get into the processing of oolongs and black teas, you actually get into a bruising process with the leaf. You want to bruise the leaf a little bit to accelerate the breakdown, to catalyze the breakdown of the enzymes in the leaf and to bring them forward, because that's what you're looking for in the taste. So there's different ways to bruise and abrade the leaf. Most common way on the small farms that we work with, you roll them up in a type of cheesecloth and you roll them out by hand on a bamboo tray or something, and then you let them dry a little bit more, and maybe you fire them a couple of times instead of like with the green tea, which you would fire once. So they take longer, a couple of days, maybe 3 days for a black tea.
Now, are the factories for processing the tea always right next to the farms where they pick the tea?
Not always. Depends on the size. We work with a lot of small farmers in China, and oftentimes we take the leaves over to a factory, yes, nearby, that would do it in town, say if the farm's outside of town.
In China, the tradition of making tea is something that goes back millennia. Are the people who do it, are the people who actually pick the tea and make the tea, especially at the level of connoisseurship that you're talking about, families with that tradition going back all those centuries and millennia?
Yes, very much so. They say that tea's been under cultivation in China for over 5,000 years. But when I was involved with some research projects in China with the American Tea Masters Association, we were primarily concerned with recreating the teas that were produced exclusively for the use of the emperors of China. So dynastic China, it ended around 1914 or 1918. So we ended up working with a lot of grandfathers that remembered the processing of these old, what's called tribute teas, that were used as a, kind of like a tax for the land, for the use of the land. And so we were working with a lot of older elders there in China, tea masters, and working with them to try to create a lot of these old teas.
Now, did they not pass that down to their children?
Well, there wasn't any use for that anymore. These were highly refined, labor-intensive, very expensive, rare, and pricey teas, so
I imagine they didn't fare well under the Cultural Revolution.
No. No, a lot of things, unfortunately, were lost during the Cultural Revolution. A lot of Taoism was affected by the revolution, as were a lot of things, as we all know.
So I was reading, I think it was in your book that you've recently written a book and many articles about tea, that some of the teas that you work with are teas that were originally created for emperors of China.
Yes. And like I said, that period ended quite a while ago, in about 1914. And so what we're trying to do is, what we were trying to do, we weren't so much trying to create a market for these teas, but we were just really curious to see if we could do it. So what we did is we formed an association of about 100 people, and we pooled all our money and sent our teacher, Roy Fung, over to China, and he worked directly with the Tea Research Institute in Hangzhou and with the Chinese government and with local farmers, and we created about 75 different research projects to create these teas, which really had been neglected and been forgotten about. But luckily we were able to, through the library at the Tea Research Institute and through Roy Fung, who's a Chinese and speaks Mandarin and Cantonese, that we have quite a catalog now of and documentation of the processing of a lot of these teas.
So when you drink some of these teas, let's say a very fine green tea or black tea or pu'er tea or whatever, oolong, that is produced in processes that had been originally reserved for the emperor or a very small number of people, how is that different than drinking a mass market tea that you could buy on the shelf here in Santa Fe?
Well, you have to use a very light hand, if you will, with the teas, because they're very delicate and you don't want to overbrew them or use the wrong water. So you have to know a little bit. You have to kind of cultivate a relationship with the tea. So you might, let's say it's a green tea, you'd want to start off with low water temperatures around 55 or 60 degrees Celsius and brew it maybe for 50 seconds first and see what it's capable of. And then you maybe, if it was a little too weak, maybe you'd raise the brewing temperatures and the times and the amount of tea. And to bring out tea's noblest qualities, you really do have to cultivate this relationship with the tea to bring it to peak capacity and have it peak out with its everything that it's capable of sharing with you.
We're talking to Frank Murphy, tea connoisseur, and he will be at the Children's Museum the third Friday of each month for the next 4 months, starting actually this Friday, April 20th, from 1 to 4 in the afternoon. During these demonstrations, you give people, and I suppose adults as well as children are able to come and check this out. What are you going to be doing? You're giving demonstrations of the whole process of tea making, tea brewing?
Yes, well, it's aimed at children and their parents, so kids are pretty tactile, so I'll be passing around a lot of different things for them to feel and to look at. And but I love working with kids. I've done a lot of work in the local elementary schools here in town. And we talk about what tea is and different types of teas, and I show them pictures of the old clipper ships that used to bring tea over from China, and I pass around different bricks and cakes of tea for them to take a look at, because they're so unusual, the compressed cakes of teas. And we talk about porcelain, and I have them touch and feel porcelain so they can get an idea and how translucent it is if they hold it up to the light. And I have them touch the teas and maybe taste, crunch on a couple of dry tea leaves, and then have them unfurl maybe the leaf buds at the end when they're all infused and swollen with water, so that they can unfold the leaves manually and see what's inside, you know, the other leaves within. And it's just really fun. Kids are really into it.
Do they get to drink the tea?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, and I'm sensitive to parents' concerns about caffeine issues, so I make a white tea which has a lot less caffeine in it, and that makes the parents happy.
We're talking to Frank Murphy. Now, there's different kinds of tea, and going up the caffeine spectrum from bottom to top, it's, I think, white, yellow, green, oolong, and then pu'er and black tea. Is that correct?
Yes, basically you start off with... I usually start with the lowest caffeine content of teas, and those are the whites, the yellows, and the green teas. And then the next classification, the next type or category is oolong teas. And then you get into the black teas, which are called red teas in China because they look red and they produce a red liqueur. And then pu'er teas is the sixth category of teas, and those are a classification of teas unto themselves, very unusual type of tea.
I'd never even heard of pu'er tea. It's how is it different from black tea?
Well, pu'er is very unique in that it's permitted to compost, if you will. The farmers let the teas compost under very controlled conditions, and some of them are naturally composted for years at a time, and some of the fermentation processes are accelerated through a closed condition by wrapping the leaves in different types of materials. But pu'er is exclusively from Yunnan province. There's a city in Yunnan called pu'er that's the distribution point of pu'er. It's not actually where pu'er is made. Most of the pu'er is harvested down near the Burmese border, down near Myanmar. And it's a large leaf tea, much like the Assam leaf is large leaf, because Assam really is only about 100 miles away from Yunnan if you want to travel across 100 miles of Burma, I think it is. So they're very similar in taste and appearance. But all pu'ers really start off as green tea, and then they become black through the fermentation process. And, you know, pu'er is really the only tea that's... is really fermented. There's been a lot of misnomers and inaccuracies about calling all tea fermented. Well, all tea is mostly oxidized. There's been a lot of confusion about that. The only tea that's really permitted to ferment with is the presence of bacterium is the pu'er tea. And then there's a whole many categories of pu'er teas. There's green pu'ers and whites and black pu'ers, but the one that everybody's familiar with, if you're familiar at all, are the black ones that come in the cakes and the interesting-looking shapes.
So a fermented, composted tea, even under controlled circumstances, is that good for you? Is that good for your stomach?
Well, it's purported to have many different, tea has all these curative properties and healing benefits that we hear about almost every month in the news. Pu'er is purported to have even more healthful benefits because it's a detoxifier, it's a digestive. The French are very excited about it. Helps them cut the fats with their rich foods. And it has the certain bacterium in them that really supplement the healthful flora in our intestinal tracts. I've had a lot of experiences I have children, and if my children happen to bring home an intestinal grip or a flu of some sort, and I think that I'm starting to get it, pu'er often helps me to process that out of my body by supplementing the flora in my intestinal tract. And I also hear from people that pu'er is also good for hangovers.
We're talking to Frank Murphy, tea connoisseur. What about other kinds of tea? Do they also have medicinal properties that you use them for, that you teach people about?
Yes, they all do. And I think most of the press has centered around the antioxidant agents, the polyphenols in tea, which are the cancer-arresting properties. That's the main thing. I think that's where all the press is. Tea has natural fluoride in it that's good for our teeth. It's got these digestive detoxifying agents in it as well. I think the most popular aspect of tea is the stimulating aspects of it. I think it's probably one of the world's most popular antidepressants in its simplicity and beneficence. It's a pretty benign product, really.
How does it compare to coffee in that respect? I've always thought that Italian espresso was the world's great antidepressant.
Oh, they all are. Chocolate, too, is right up there. Well, as far as caffeine goes, tea has about half the caffeine in it. But I'm reading these wonderful things about coffee and chocolate about having extraordinary antioxidant properties. So that's really quite extraordinary.
We're talking to Frank Murphy, and it's all about tea. I mean, it's overwhelming. I never thought about how much there is to know about this subject. And I was wondering, you were talking about very specific, very highly cultivated, specially crafted teas that that are made in presumably pretty small quantities. What about mass market tea? Is that made in the same way, or is it really a whole different animal?
It really is a different animal because, excuse me, a lot of the teas are picked by machine and processed by machine, so they never really are handled by people. And it kind of has to be that way because, tea is the second most consumed beverage in the world next to water. So we're talking about mass production in South America and Africa. So it really has to be, we're also talking about large corporations that are involved with the production of this stuff. And that's how I was born and raised basically in New England on tea bag tea with Tetley and Salada and Twinings and everything. That's the foundations of my tea education was those types of mass-produced teas. And there's certainly nothing wrong with those, what I call milk and sugar teas. They have their place. But as a friend of mine likes to say, when you start putting milk and sugar into tea, it ceases to become tea and kind of becomes a food group. But again how I was raised. And, one of my other friends talks about the tea and tea bag tea as being the lowest common denominator. But again, you have to remember that these teas produce and fulfill most of the world's tea needs, so you really can't knock them.
Do they include twigs? I mean, one can buy twig tea, which I guess is a different thing that comes from the twigs and not from the leaves. But what about regular teas? If they're harvested by machines, do they have twigs as well as leaves in them?
Some of them do, but they're so ground up and pulverized that you wouldn't see a twig like you would in some of the Chinese teas because some of the twigs, there's actually twig tea, kukicha, and there's another Japanese tea,
bacha
tea, include a lot of twigs in the teas, and some of them are exclusively twigs. And in some of the teas that I deal with, you still see the leaves attached to the actual twig, and that enhances taste. And it also prevents certain types of burning of the leaf if you're high-firing certain teas.
The time is 8:32 here on KSFR, and we're going to take a very brief break to hear from some of our beloved underwriters. So stay tuned to KSFR.
Witness the exploits of vaudevillian Velma Kelly and chorus girl Roxy Hart as they try to paw their way back into the spotlight from behind bars in the Chicago Cook County Jail in the 1920s. Chicago, the musical, a stage and screen success for over 30 years, comes to the College of Santa Fe during the last two weekends of April, opening on April 20th. For tickets, call the Greer Garson Theater box office at 473-6511. This message is sponsored by College of Santa Fe, a tax-exempt organization.
Outpost Productions and Padmini continue their celebration of Padmini's 10th anniversary with a much-anticipated concert event featuring the legendary tabla virtuoso Zakir Hussain and India's greatest living santur player, Pandit Shiv Kumar Sharma. Tuesday, April 24th, 7 p.m. at the Lensic in Santa Fe. For info, call 268-0044 or visit outpostspace.org. This message sponsored by Outbus Productions, a tax-exempt organization.
And back to tea connoisseur Frank Murphy. We're talking about the manufacture of tea. There's many questions in coffee and chocolate, the other two food groups, about things like organic products, fair trade products, and so on. Is this another industry in which labor is terribly exploited, or how does the tea industry work?
Well, I think labor is always exploited in some capacity, but I don't think we're going to find fair trade issues in China so much, but a lot of companies are working with companies in India specifically where fair trades can be implemented. Certainly in Africa and Taiwan and Ceylon, Sri Lanka and South America, those are coming up. And a lot of the tea companies now are advertising a lot of their teas as fair trade. And, of course, the organic issues, another lot of companies are advertising their teas as being organic. And there's all kinds of guidelines and requirements that would qualify a company for being able to advertise those things.
Let's talk about the brewing of a cup of tea. So you have these wonderful tea leaves that you've ordered straight from China, and it's shortly after the harvest time, and here we are in let's say, early April. Then you were speaking about cultivating a relationship with the tea, getting to know the tea. My understanding is that every tea requires a different whole technique of brewing before it even gets to the cup.
Yes, and that's why, again, you have to do this relational type of dialogue with the tea. Say for a green tea, you would put a teaspoon or so of tea in the bottom of your brewing vessel and sprinkle a little hot water over the leaves to smell the fragrance and the aroma of the tea. And then you'd pour the warm water or the hot water, depending on the tea, over the leaves and let
them brew. Are there some teas that don't require hot water but only warm?
Yes, more of these particularly really refined teas that I'm talking about, you'd only be brewing at 55 to 60 degrees Celsius, which is pretty low. I think we're talking about 140 degrees Fahrenheit.
Yeah,
here.
Way under boiling point.
Yes, and that's because they're really delicate. You don't want to oversteep the leaves because you'll stew them, you'll cook them, and what you're trying to do is coax the nectar from the leaf. You're not trying to cook the leaf or cook the nectar. You're trying to coax from the leaf all these benefits of the leaf, so of the tea. So what you do is start out with, again, a light hand and brew the teas at lower temperatures. And then if you feel it's maybe the tea has some more to offer or can bend and turn a little bit more, you'd start the next infusion, or you'd start over with new leaves, say with a warmer, hotter temperature and a longer infusion time. But as you go through the scale, the white and the green and the yellow teas are more delicate. The oolongs are more forgiving and flexible. You can use hotter water temperatures and longer infusion times. And, of course, the black teas, a lot of them are made for boiling water, and that's what you want. You want to be able to brew them longer periods of time with hotter water.
Now, in New Mexico, water boils at a considerably lower temperature, probably about 10 to 15 degrees lower than it would at sea level. So can you get your water hot enough here to make your tea?
Yes, you're absolutely right, Mary Charlotte. We're up at 7,000 feet, so the water boils here about 196, 198 degrees Fahrenheit. And yes, there are a couple of ways you can make it a couple of degrees warmer. You can let it sit on the stove for a little while and boil. You don't want to do that too long because then the water will go flat. Or you can nuke it. You know, put it in a microwave if you feel disposed to do that. I don't particularly go that route. But I've noticed that when I am backed into a corner and I have to have microwave tea, that I have noticed that the water is hotter here up at 7,000 feet.
Now, what kind of water do you use?
Well, that's a pivotal question because tea is mostly water. So you really have to be attentive to the water that you use. I use deionized water, and most tea connoisseurs do not. They use water that's been passed through a reverse osmosis membrane, and that brings the water down to about 20 to 40 parts per million total dissolved solids. You have to remember that Santa Fe's water is, I think, generally about 400 parts per million total dissolved solids, and that will kill a tea outright, just flat out. So if you can get bottled water or filtered water, or go to Wild Oats, Whole Foods, or the Water Boys, or someplace like that, and buy the bulk water, reverse osmosis is the best route to go.
What about a charcoal filter like Brita?
I think anything's going to help the local water here. I have a Brita thing at home, and I just use that for drinking water. But with tea water, I'm apt to go with deionized water, which is what I've found to be the best water to bring out tea's intrinsic values.
And distilled water doesn't cut it for you?
Well, there's not really a lot of difference between distilled water and deionized water. They both have absolutely no minerals in them. But distilled water has that extra step added to it, where it's steam distilled, it's boiled, and it actually is quite oxygen lacking. So as far as both, and it's more flat tasting if you brew tea with it. I haven't particularly noticed that because of the similarities of deionized water and distilled water.
Now, if I made you a cup of tea with distilled water and the same cup of tea, same technique, same everything with deionized water, and you didn't know which was which, could you really tell the difference?
No. Basically, I could not tell the difference. No, and I've had people do things like that before where they put out about six different cups of tea, of water, and you try to go through them, and of course you're gonna tell what the tap water is because of the fluoride in it and chlorine.
And the chlorine.
Yes.
You can tell I can smell a cup of tap water and a cup of filtered water, and you can just smell the difference without even tasting
it. Yes, that's pretty radical, you know, that those are the 180 degree differences of the waters, yes.
When you learn as a student of tea from your tea master, what is your training like? What do you do? How long does it take? What are your days like?
Well, my first formal training was at Jade Brook Tea House in San Francisco, and my first teacher was a tea master, and he was the headmaster of the American Tea Masters Association. And the first week intensive was 5 days of about 10 to 12 hours a day in this tea house. And it would involve everything from tasting teas, going through hundreds and hundreds of teas over this five-day period, going through tea chemistry, brewing techniques, all the different types of teas, what made them different, harvesting, soil conditions, weather conditions, elevations, things to change teas and to make them do what we wanted to make them do, manipulating teas, right down to history of tea, all kinds of different, every aspect of tea that you can imagine.
And so you sit there in a small group of disciples with the tea master and basically hear lectures, or what's it like?
No, I was actually by myself sitting across a table much like this one at the baking company, a very small table. In the middle of that table, set down into it, was the tray that we would brew the tea on, that the teacher would brew the tea on. And he would talk the whole time, pretty much, and I would be free to ask questions. And he would go through all the different brewing techniques. And then I think the most important thing was that we would talk about the taste of the tea. Because after I completed this program of about 2 years where I was shuttling back and forth between Santa Fe and San Francisco, I began to qualify to be a judge at international tea competitions, and that's what they had me do after my formal training. But I think most of it had to do with discussing the teas as they brewed and what they tasted like after they were brewed, after they were decanted into the tasting cups. And that really was most of what we focused on, sensitive, very ethereal innuendos and of tea, of which there are many. There are some teas that I really didn't have a palate to taste when they were first made for me. Teas that had just won, like, first prize at the China National Tea Competitions in China. They were so delicate and ethereal that I couldn't get a handle on them. I really missed what was going on there. And then once I had my palate trained and educated, I could begin to taste some of those incredibly ethereal, haunting tastes of tea that really eluded me initially.
When you're tasting tea all day, do you get to a point of diminishing returns where you just don't want to taste anymore, or where you lose your ability to discern?
No, I think that it's just the opposite. You tend to get heightened because you're drinking so much tea, and you are not evacuating, as you would say during a wine tasting. You're not spitting the tea out. We're sitting there. You don't want to spit the tea out if these teas are extremely, you know, rare and priceless. But what actually happens is certainly your mouth chemistry is going to be changing as you fill your body with more caffeine as the day progresses. And certainly all your senses are going to be enhanced. So in a way, you become more sensitized to the taste sensations because everything is so, you know, enhanced and jacked up, if you will, from the tea.
Well, speaking of jacked up, if you're drinking tea all day, it's not like wine where you would be getting plastered if you swallowed it, but you are getting pretty caffeinated.
Yes, you are, and everybody has their limits on tea. I certainly do. I can only have tea once a day because I have such a caffeine sensitivity. So you really have to know where your cutoff line is there. And there's all kinds. Like when I was at the competitions, I was drinking 40 to 60 cups of tea a day. And I had to really
We're talking
learn.
Little tiny cups.
Yeah. No, we're talking... In that respect, we're talking hundreds of teacups a day. But
heavens.
The teacups... We brew in these containers called Gaiwans, which are... like a teacup. The original English teacup was modeled on these Gaiwans. They're a three-piece brewing vessel, and they have a little saucer underneath and a lid that goes on top of it. And then, of course, the English added the handle at the end on the side there. But no, we're talking about 40 to 60 teacups a day because we would reinfuse the teas during these competitions and during the tea tastings to see again what they were capable of. We were taking them through 3, 4, 5, 6 infusions if they were a green tea. So drinking a lot of tea. But the thing that I found instead of, you know, initially I was up all night and trying to flush the, drinking a lot of water and eating protein to try to help absorb the caffeine. But today there's a very specific agent that will help you, that actually helps to antidote the caffeine, and that's an amino acid called L-theanine, capital L-capital T-H-E-A-N-I-N-E.
And that absorbs caffeine?
It does two things. It antidotes caffeine, and it also is tea's primary relaxant. So when you get those nice, soothing, warm, soft sensations of tea, that's what's happening in your body.
Tea actually has this ingredient in it.
Yes.
As well as the caffeine.
Yes, it has an agent in it that helps our bodies to process the caffeine.
This summer at the Santa Fe Opera is an opera called Tea, A Mirror of Soul by composer Tan Dun. You're also going to be doing things with the opera, including an open house on Saturday, May 19th. Tell us about this opera. It must have been amazing for you to come across this, you as a tea master, tea connoisseur.
Yes, I didn't know about it until some of the opera people began to tell me about it. And I was first puzzled, perplexed how anyone could write an opera about tea. But this gentleman is a Chinese Taoist, and he has brought a lot of Taoist elements and motifs into this opera. And it's circles around a kind of a doomed love affair between a Chinese princess and a Japanese monk. And it starts off during a Japanese tea ceremony in Japan and then moves to, most of it takes place in Tang Dynasty China and then moves back to Japan. But most of it takes place in China. But once I viewed the video, you can get it. Deutsche Grammophon has put out a recording of its first presentation, I think, at the Suntory Theater in Japan. I think I can't remember when it came out, but you can get it through Amazon.com. But I was really amazed at how he brought in all these different Taoist motifs of everything from the five elements of Taoism to all the haunting aspects of tea that I referred to earlier, right down to how tea really encourages and almost forces you to slow down to prepare it, and that's part of tea's allure. And so one thing that was really wonderful about the opera was that there's a lot of very slow, deliberate movements in the opera, almost like people are walking in a walking meditation stance that might remind you of Kabuki or the No Theaters, where you really are pulled into the whole process of tea making. And it's just an extraordinary opera. I was really impressed at how he pulled it off. And I think part of how he pulled it off was that he interviewed a lot of Japanese and Chinese tea masters to really understand the whole process.
Now, the relationship to Taoism is something that we talked about a little bit at the beginning, but let's go on with that. What is the relationship between this whole art of tea and this religious spiritual practice called Taoism?
Well, that's a good question. We don't know the history of tea so much in Taoism. I know that when I go to Taoist temples, there's often tea laid out, much like at a Buddhist temple where you see liquid out in front of a shrine. There's often tea at a shrine in the Taoist temples. And I think that... I'm not so sure of the Taoist elements. I know I do my own private rituals where I involve my own Taoist practice in the tea. And what that means is that I invoke the five elements or the spirits of the tea even to help me make the tea. And sometimes I even pray, if you will, over my tea to enhance it in some capacity, whether it's, you know, running chi through my arm, down my hand to put into the tea, or, and that can be also just described as putting my love or my blessings into the tea to help it along, kind of encourage it a little bit.
Now, there is a goddess of tea, I guess it's a goddess of tea named Thea.
Yes.
Who's, a goddess of light, too. What is her history and what's her relationship to tea?
Well, every time you read anything about Chinese tea, the stories of the ancient history of Chinese tea is often... there's always this feminine presence that comes in with tea when the Chinese talk about tea, whether it's Kuan Yin or fairies or devas of some sort or another. But the actual goddess of tea is Thea, T-H-E-A, and you see that recurring a lot in the different... chemical and biological names of tea. L-theanine, certainly it's still there. And in the homeopathic remedies, Thea sinensis is still extant. But the word Thea sinensis is the original Western Latin and scientific name for tea. And that was bestowed upon tea, I think, back in early on 1720 or something. And we don't know really if the name Thea was bestowed upon tea for the specific reasons of it being a goddess. But the goddess of tea is a pre-Hellenic goddess of light. The actual goddess Thea is a goddess of light and luminaries. And that's exactly what tea does. You know, she really infuses us with light. Like when I'm sludging along through what I call my dark and heavily forested regions of my psyche, a cup of tea will bring me to a sunny little knoll with a view. And I feel the light on my back, warming my back, and my body, whole body starts to let down, I start to feel that relaxing quality of tea take over me and just calm me right down.
You have talked about the tea and the water being a marriage with bride and bridegroom or something like that. Which is which? What's the water and what's the tea? I was just struck by the fact that you used tea as a in the feminine just a moment ago.
Yes, well, actually, water is very feminine as well, so I really wouldn't know which is more yang and which is more yin, you know, getting into that whole aspect of it. But yes, there is this, I talked about when we had our conversation about water and the marriage, this union of tea, I was talking about this marriageable eligibility of the water. And how you have to really look for a water that's... and I think I was talking about it as the bridegroom in a sense of this, the sacrament of the union even, about bringing the water and the tea together to make this wonderful, you know, elixir that we love so much.
There's a real, I guess, rich metaphorical and almost poetic sense in this. I mean, when you very kindly allowed me to taste some of the teas that you're talking about, there was this feeling of, you know, birth, flowering, and decline, and death that is inherent in this process of making and drinking the tea.
Yes, it's, well, you know, it's really transporting, transfixing experience to drink some of these teas. And I think that's why my book focuses on the spirit, the feminine spirituality of tea. You know, I've written poetry in the past, and I'm hard-pressed to explain some of these taste sensations that I have with tea. And where are those places that tea takes me? And a lot of times I just can't explain, I can't articulate that. But there is a lot of transporting experiences with tea, and that's why I think it's so popular with religious and spiritual people, because it does have this experience of mystical. You know, we hear a lot about the healthful benefits of tea, but the mystical aspects of tea really don't get any press, and that's what I address in my book.
Now, this book is not out yet, but it's finished, and we hope to see it in sometime perhaps later in the year or early next year?
I hope so. It's called Thunder in the Lake, The Spirit of Tea. And it's the Thunder in the Lake part is based on the I Ching from the hexagram number 17, which I feel best captures the essence of tea. Thunder in the middle of the lake is actually the image of hexagram number 17.
So the lake being the water and the thunder being the tea leaves?
Yes, exactly. The lake being the water and the thunder being the resonance of the caffeine, if you will. And there's also a couple of other, you know, stimulants in caffeine. Most people focus on the caffeine issues, but there's two other stimulants in tea, the theobromine and theophylline.
Now, you are going to be involved with the opera to some extent. There's going to be an open house on Saturday, the 19th of March, from 10 to 2 in the afternoon, and you will be there also talking about tea.
Yes, I'll be there with the St. James Tea Room in Albuquerque, which is an incredible place to have tea. And I'll be there serving tea and fielding questions and lecturing about tea. And also my friend James Norwood Pratt will be there. He'll actually be on the premises there hand-firing tea and walks with new fresh green tea. And I think that will be quite an extraordinary thing to witness.
So people can actually see how it goes from being a fresh leaf to being something that you can put in your cup.
Yes. They can actually witness the process and see it and smell it and feel it and embody that entire experience.
Now, is green tea really better for you than black tea?
Well, that's what they say. I think they're discovering a lot of the benefits of black tea as well. But I think on the whole, most of the emphasis and the research has been on green tea.
So, if people want to learn more about tea, having heard how much richness there is that maybe they'd never even heard of, I certainly hadn't, how can people study further and where can people get tea, which is of that higher quality, and start to actually get to know tea in a more sophisticated way?
Well, there's lots of books out there. James Norwood Pratt certainly has written a book called The New Tea Lover's Treasury, which is an extraordinary book, and I think it's going to be available in town at different places, and certainly up at the opera tea shop, the gift shop up there, and you can order it on the web, and there's incredible information on the web about tea. And I think a good place to start, if you're really interested, would be to get on to Whole Foods. I was just down there the other day, and they had a number of wonderful bulk teas that you can buy just, a half an ounce, just a little baggie of different types of teas from the Rishi Tea Company, from Silk Road Tea Company. And they even had bulk teas from Taylor's of Harrogate, from for all you English drinking people out there, English tea drinking people.
Well, Frank Murphy, I want to thank you so much for being here today on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe.
Well, thank you for having me, Mary Charlotte.
And we will see you at the Children's Museum this Friday from 1 to 4, and for the next 3 or 4 months, for the next 4 months, every third Friday of the month from 1 to 4. So if you can make it down there, you can see some of the stuff in action.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org, and we are podcasting. You can find us at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Santa Fe's Dotfoil Computer Services. You can send me an email at radiocafe@ksfr.org or leave a message at 428-1528. Thanks to Marilyn LeBlanc for engineering today. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team, and after that, jazz.